Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. This is your host, Stone Payton, and in the studio with me this morning is my good buddy and co-host, Lee Cantor. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Stone. How you been?
I'm doing well. Looks like you made up with the barber, man.
Yes, I'm winning. Or actually, they were winning.
So, I guess it's been all of 2 days since we worked together, but I still got to ask, what you been up to?
I've been training. Working out.
You're looking very spelt. You're looking toned. Did you have higher energy these days?
No, I wish that was the case. I'm hungrier and I have less energy. But I counter that with coffee.
But I love what you're doing because the workout that you're doing, you're going with your family and you're walking to the workout, you're walking back. I'm very impressed and a little bit jealous, I got to say.
That's right. You can follow. My wife has been blogging about this on the Dr. Fitness blog, and you can track how we've been doing 3 days a week.
Cool. Well, listen, I got to give a shout out. You know, I went down to Pensacola over the weekend. God bless her. We buried my grandmother. It was time, and she certainly had a great ride. And it was actually, you know, when you bury someone that's had a good life, it's really more about celebrating life. And it was really really a great time. It was a good chance to catch up with a lot of family. And of course, everybody ate really well, and I'm not going to be able to tuck my shirt in for another 6 months. Mm-hmm. But one of the very bright spots for me in this weekend was getting a chance to visit with my great aunt, no ordinary aunt, my great aunt, Blanche, who was my grandmother's younger sister. And I wanted to give a shout out to Blanche because I think Aunt Blanche might be listening to us this morning.
She's internet savvy.
That's mm-hmm. Oh, is she internet savvy? She's out of Hartselle, Alabama, so she had to get up an hour earlier to listen to us, right? It's 9 o'clock over there. But what was so interesting and fun is the conversation centered around her navigating through her iPad. And she's doing the whole bit with the fingers and all that and showing me pictures of Wesley and the grandchildren. And so good morning, Aunt Blanche. We're glad to have you join us. We've got a great show this morning. We got a studio full. And first up on the High Velocity Radio Show, it is my pleasure to introduce the Grand Poobah over at Intel Partners, Mr. Ted Malden. Thanks for coming, man. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Thank you.
Yeah, we are delighted to have you, man. So Intel Partners, give us a little bit of a feel for what you guys are out there doing for folks.
Sure. I would characterize our business as a management consulting firm. We do a lot of work with small businesses, but we also have an enterprise practice where we are delivering services and really trying to help our customers affect capacity and demand and business performance in their operations and getting fidelity in those operations. So
well, that explains the tie.
Yeah.
Ted's the only one in the studio with a tie, guys.
It's a habit.
So say more.
Yeah, no, absolutely. To that extent, we've got the enterprise practice where we're doing work, for example, with Coca-Cola Refreshments on helping them work out the details and the implementation of services around SAP. And then we have an internal mid-market practice primarily characterized by a relationship with Microsoft. And we've got what we're trying to do is build an A-team with the organization where we bring the best players we can to the business and bring those minds to bring some thought leadership to how we affect those customers and our clients and help them grow and manage their business better.
Now, what is the pain that these companies are having where they're like, you know what, we got to call Ted's group?
Well, I think in generally we come to those discussions differently depending on the customer, but primarily speaking, we may have customers that are trying to get better handle on their sales operations, what that looks like from a throughput from their sales operations related to conversion rates between opportunities and how that affect their operations. But we also ask important questions with their organization about how you're managing your cost, the bottom line of their business, and effectively, you know, what makes up a perfect invoice? You know, what are the constituent parts of your cost? And what we're trying to do is get a better understanding what those strategic priorities are and what those tactical imperatives need to be, you know, what those first steps need to be in solving those kinds of problems. And what we'll do is we'll partner with leadership in those organizations and also down at the call center level or some other part of the operational part of the business to really start understanding what those problems are and then finding the right solutions. We're a system agnostic shop in general. even though we have some core competencies in technology. But that's really what we're trying to do, is gap what their business complexities are with some tools that will help them drive better performance in their business operations.
Now, what does that perfect invoice look like?
The perfect invoice looks means that it gets paid right away.
That's what I was thinking.
So, well, it's not like yellow or red.
No. It's all about making sure it gets paid right away. And sometimes you might find a situation where they didn't get a receiving ticket, or you don't have a receiving ticket on file. So we want to figure out, make sure that we've got the proper document management in place. And we also work with a partner nationally to be able to service some of those needs, Rico Icon, the copier company. But they're really in the you think of them as hardware, you know, your copier out in the office,
right.
But they really have some nice technologies that integrate well with some of that. So we want to make sure we have that receiving ticket. So you're delivering products to your customers. You want to make sure that you have that fidelity so that you can get that invoice paid quicker.
That has to be some very interesting conversations and some interesting distinctions between perception among, you talked about working and talking with the C-level, working the C-suite, but also with the rank and file on the shop floor. What is that like, and do you help bring those two perspectives together?
They probably work seamlessly.
Yeah.
They don't need a lot of help.
They always do, so there's never a problem there.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
No, really, there's you know, there's the big strategic requirements, you know, how the business is going to grow and what those priorities are from a C-level perspective, and really what that roadmap looks like for them. But we got to get down to the nuts and bolts of, all right, who gets that piece of paper? How does the product get picked off the shelf? You know, for example, and those are the kind of things that, you know, we got to gap that. And so we're really, you know, we've got some guys that roll up their sleeves, and kind of get down to those details and make sure that, you know, at the end of the day, at the end of the project, we want to make sure that not only that we meet those strategic growth objectives from a C level, but we're not impacting current revenue and current operations as it relates to being able to service their customers.
Now, you guys must have a great staff to be able to kind of adapt to all the different clients you have.
Yeah, well, I think we've got the best staff, and I think that's one of our biggest differences between us and maybe some of the other people that are doing the same kind of work. We've got thought leadership on our enterprise practice, effectively what we're doing there is we're bringing the best people we can, you know, former guys that have provided thought leadership, former CIOs that are going to really kind of work out what that strategy needs to look like, for example. But on the mid-market practice, we have 20% of the Microsoft MVPs on the Dynamics GP side worldwide.
Wow.
And I really, you know, I speak highly. Most of the time I speak about those guys. So we've got Frank Hamley and Mariano Gomez in that capacity leading that mid-market effort, doing the same type of work, but really from a subject matter expert from that perspective. We with that, those competencies, we are currently engaged in delivery services or project delivery services in 9 countries right now, in North and South America, Europe, and the Middle East. And combined, I think we all carry somewhere around 7 different languages. So that really helps us get to those international markets as well.
I'll bet it does.
Yeah.
So how do you go about hiring for what you do? Because you do it every day.
Right.
But a little advice, if you would, for folks that might be thinking about engaging someone like you. I mean, you have a wonderful vocabulary. You sound to me like you know what you're talking about. But so I bet you the next guy is very articulate as well. What questions do you ask? How do you know who to pick?
We open the phone book and
we
start picking names out. No, really what we do is we work closely in our community of subject matter experts or folks that really have some real credibility. And that may be that we work with I think we're a pretty good recruiting firm as well. So we want to recruit the best talent we can to bring some real thought leadership to affect change for our customers as it relates to you know, how they continue to that they've been in the trenches for the most part, that have really got into those nuts and bolts, and either and have grown up from being just a, you know, an associate consultant that worked their way up into those type of leadership roles that are now participating in thought leadership and driving initiatives internally and direction in different companies. So
now when you're working with a client, can you kind of walk us through what that's like? Is your first foray in there, is it a project, or do they, you have to do an RFP? Like, what's it like for you to kind of introduce yourself to a client?
All the above. I think, you know, really what we're doing is we usually get brought into the conversation because there's somebody that has a specific need.
Right.
Okay.
So it might be a project. It might be.
Sure, absolutely. But what we don't want to do is we just don't want to go in there and configure a solution. We want to make sure, and how we, to answer your question, how we engage in that is we want to make sure that we understand exactly how that's going to benefit the organization.
But is it more holistic, or is it kind of, you know, acute care?
No, it's we may get in some tactical type work where we're just trying to solve a specific problem.
Right.
But from the delivery leadership perspective, we get into that conversation holistically. We want to make sure holistically
that it's going to make sense for the long term, not just solve one little problem today.
Absolutely. Right. So it's a parallel effort where we've got our delivery leadership focused on holistic value and how we create value for those customers, while we've got tactical resources in there
that are solving whatever that fire is today.
Sure. Exactly.
Now, do you find much of your work remedial at all, meaning that the organization makes a large capital investment in an SAP or an Oracle or a Bond or one of these ERP systems, and they think, well, we got the stuff, so that ought to, and they don't think through and maybe engage someone like you, and then now they're calling you in and saying, oh, my gracious, we come in and help us get this thing going right?
Yeah, I mean, we find a lot of work like that.
Is that right?
And it's not a criticism certainly of anybody how they may have implemented the solution initially.
It's a little bit of a criticism.
No, it's not at all. Not at all.
A little wee bit.
Well,
you sound like De Niro in that movie. You insulted him just a little.
Well, you know, when any organization starts to implement a solution, there are 30 or 50 priority ones, and what we try to do.
And the sales guy told him it would fix the problem,
right?
And it would make the phone calls for him and close
right?
the deals
exactly.
automatically. So we just want to make sure that when we're having those conversations and we're trying to affect that kind of change,
right.
we really want to make sure that that when we're engaging in those situations where an organization needs some remediation.
Right.
And truthfully,
I was just kidding. I know it's not their fault, but they don't know what they don't know. And then you do this all the time. So you know where the landmines are.
Well, yeah, but we think we do. I mean, we
have a better shot than me if I've never done this and I just buy this off the shelf and then I expect this to solve some problem.
Absolutely. But, you know, regardless of where they are in that implementation, there's always some remediation that needs to happen. And along those lines is, you know, as somebody grows and they, for example, let's look at somebody's sales operations. Mm-hmm. There's certainly ways to remediate and better interact with your customers, how those systems drive customer loyalty, internal teamwork.
Right.
Those are the kind of things that can easily be remediated. And we get into a lot of that as well. And I think we get creative as well as how we solve those kind of problems, just based on our experience and our operational experience.
Now, do you specialize in any verticals, or are you guys kind of generalists?
We all have experience with healthcare and high-tech organizations and service organizations, but currently right now we have... And maybe to some extent there may be some oversaturation in people focusing in those areas,
mm-hmm.
but we have some specific IP as it relates to mergers and acquisitions, energy, oil and gas,
mm-hmm.
and manufacturing. And for example, Frank Hamley, he's one of our Microsoft Dynamics MVPs. And he's got very specific experience in the manufacturing space. But on the merger acquisition space, you know, you've got two companies coming together. We work with private equity organizations, and they're bringing together companies. And really, you know, how do you bring these two organizations together? You have duplicate customers, duplicate vendors. What's the strategy? And what we do a lot of times is we'll take those two systems and we'll put them in the cloud as a transition solution and get the those customers and those vendors and those invoices and push all that in the cloud as a step to be able to normalize not only the data that we need to address,
right,
but really help them work on normalizing their business processes. So when you normalize those business processes, you effectively make a change on the data and normalizing that. And so if we can normalize all those kind of things, then I know that at that point, then we are, as Intel Partners, are creating a multiplier for that organization.
Right.
You mentioned the word landmines a little while ago, Lee. What are some of the typical landmines in that you see in your M&A work, in your merger and acquisition work?
I think the biggest landmines is really making sure, for example, our last merger integration activity was that the customer had $22 million in open AR and another system that was separate from these other systems that were coming together. And how do you start to collect? How do you manage that? And how do you collect some of that? So really trying to figure out how you integrate that into this new environment, and how do you make sure that the call center folks from the old organizations are going to still work to collect that other revenue, you know? And that's really important. And just really, I think, overall strategy, I mean, you want to incrementally lay out a plan that builds. So what we don't want to do is we don't want to try and we don't want everything to be a priority one. And and if you do that, then I think you're
but that's what you walk into, isn't it? A lot of times you got like 50 priority ones, right? When
absolutely.
You walk into an M&A situation,
every day it seems like
what's
that.
The most number of priority ones you should have? Just a rule of thumb, like 10 priority
10
ones?
Or less.
10 or less.
Yes.
But all kidding aside, the human side of this whole equation can mean as much to the bottom line as getting the paper and the math right, right?
Absolutely. I think the biggest emphasis that we have, whether it's merger acquisitions or manufacturing something, is making sure that we align the processes and the people and the system so that they're all working together, so everybody's pulling in the same direction. Because if you've got one part of the organization working differently than the other part of the organization, you kind of don't know who's called on what customer and what capacity they're working with those customers, and or internally operationally, you've got internal customers you've got demand for. So
well, Ted, whatever they're paying you over there, it's not enough, buddy. I appreciate you coming in the studio and giving us a little bit of insight into this. What's the best way for our listeners to get in touch with you and learn more about your services?
Sure, you can find us on the web at www.intelpartners.com, and that's Intel with two L's. And you can reach me directly at tmaldin@intelpartners.com, and that's TMauldin.
Well, thanks.
Before he goes, is there anything going on event or anything happening?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. We've got actually upcoming, we've got probably three ways that you can kind of get some more visibility in what we're doing and what we're trying to provide our customers. One way is through our blogs, and I didn't mention this earlier, but for example, Mariano Gomez, he has a blog. He gets 1,200 visits a day worldwide on his blog.
Wow!
And that's really another way we're trying to share our.
So this is the brains behind the whole outfit, just Mariano.
why
didn't we book Mariano? That's the guy with the juice. What are we talking to this guy
all right,
for?
I'll bring him next time. and then Frank, he gets over 5,000 visits a month on his blog. And they're both different. One's more of a developer's blog, and the other one's more of an end-user blog. And then both these guys are actually speaking in Vegas in November at the GPUG Summit, which is a Microsoft-type, end-user-type summit. And then, for several years, they both have spoken at Microsoft's annual conference, and it's in a different location every year. But they spoke last year, and they're speaking again next year, so... Those are really the kind of the ways we reach out to our customers, and it's it's been working well for us, and we enjoy that interaction.
So that's a good place to start, then, as our listeners can tap into these blogs and start getting some insight into the true nature of your work.
Absolutely.
All right. You know, I think what might be fun, too, if you'd be up for it sometime, I'd love to have you. You can bring Mariano and the other guy, too, but I'm thinking maybe bring a delighted customer in sometime, and let's hear from their perspective.
We would love to do that.
Yeah. That could be fun. You
cool
definitely.
With
that? All right. Should we, like, charge a fee for that? Or?
No. Ted's a good guy.
Fair. Hey, can you hang out with us while we visit with our next guest?
Absolutely.
Thanks, man. Well, next up on the High Velocity Radio Show this morning is the lady who runs Love of Learning, LLC, Miss Danielle Viviers. Welcome to the show, Danielle.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. So you run a business that helps students prepare for exams, prepare for college. It's a tutoring organization, is that what it is?
It is. I started it about 2 years ago, and what we do is mainly focus on high schoolers and kind of making sure they're staying on top of things and getting good grades on their tests. But more importantly, we do a lot of SAT, ACT prep for standardized tests. And right now, my busy time is college applications.
Are they they're filling out college applications already?
Yeah.
Didn't school just start?
Yeah, it did. It did start, but for kids who want to apply early admission, those deadlines are coming up in October. And then regular admissions, I mean, you start applying for November, December, so.
Now, when you're dealing with these high school kids, do you find them to be smart, or they're just lazy, or are they just not smart?
Well, I kind of have a broad spectrum, I would say. You know, you have your 4.0 student who wants to get a 4.3.
Right.
And then you have students who could care less. And you really have the full gamut.
What do you prefer to work with?
Well, I think in high school I was a bit of a nerd. So,
you
for
were the
me,
4.0 student?
4.2, yes.
4.2. So
for me, I love that because it's more of a challenge for me.
Now, why weren't you 4.3?
I know. I tried.
What happened? You I didn't know. Have a tutor?
It was I got a B. I got a B my first semester of calculus.
And that was it?
That was a
you
killer.
You remember that?
Oh, yes. That was a that dreadful you. Experience. Yes. So I definitely do not tutor in calculus, but I do have another tutor who does that. And so
what's your sweet spot? What do you like to tutor?
Well, I was an English major, so.
Well, you speak English very well. I
oh,
say.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Almost fluently.
I do. Yes. So I like, you know, I started out doing SAT and ACT, the reading sections.
Uh-huh.
And over time, you know, realized that I guess I don't hate math that much. So I do a little bit of both.
Uh-huh. Now, do you find that kids, are they having more problems in math or are they having more problems in language arts?
Honestly, it depends on the test. Uh-huh. It depends on the student. But across the board, you know, I've done practice tests now because I do like to take the test as if, you know, I was a student so I can see how it feels to, you know, how to approach it and what to do first. And
right. Are there any tips? Is it always B?
Yes.
Always pick B?
No. That's not the tip. But I have taken practice tests and gotten perfect scores, which is proof
that
tutoring helps.
So. Now, do you find that there are some kids that really, they're very good in whatever the subject is, but for whatever reason, they're not all that great at taking tests?
Oh, my
really
gosh, yes.
Is that true or that's a myth?
Nope, it's true. I have lots and lots of students who are super, super smart, who do great at school, and they just have really bad test anxiety, which is a very common problem.
So how do you deal with that?
Well, the thing for them is what I try and do is, you know, when we're actually in the tutoring environment,
right?
Sometimes we make it as stressful as possible.
Really?
So instead of giving them 35 minutes for a section, you would give them 28 minutes for a section.
Oh, wow.
I would open the door so it's loud and distracting.
Don't let them go to the bathroom.
How do you know
this? Could be fun. I don't know. I'm just thinking this could
be
like
not that mean. But for them, you basically have to give them the confidence in knowing that they can do it.
Oh, so the thinking is if you could do it in this environment, it'll be easy to do it in
the
test.
So if I can give them the most difficult problems, have them in a distracting environment and prove to them that they can still do well and complete it in the time.
Right.
Then why can't they do it on the test?
Easy, right? Because if they survive this.
And don't get me wrong, I don't do that every time. We do have productive tutoring time.
Right.
But it is, it's good to prove to them that, you know, if they can do it there, they can do it anywhere.
Right.
See, if I were a tutor, I would be so tempted to do like Mr. Miyagi. Go wash the car every right. Friday, wax on, wax off, you know, build a fence, cut the grass, and this then, will help you in your essay.
Do you do tricks like that?
No, not yet, but that is a pretty good idea.
You can get them to clean your place.
Yeah.
And, wash your car.
Now, I have, I won't say studied because that would be an unfair characterization, but I have been exposed to the idea that sometimes different people learn differently, you know,
yes.
through different channels. Have you experienced that? And if so, how do you address that in your work?
Well, different people do learn differently. And for that, you really have to adjust your approach. Some students learn a lot better one-on-one, which I definitely do believe that students learn best one-on-one. When you do group settings, you know, some student may work faster, some student may have certain weaknesses, and you really do have to play to their strengths. So, you know, if they're a visual learner, if they're an auditory learner, you have to be able to adjust and adapt your teaching style to their learning style.
Now, so you do primarily one-on-one tutoring, is that right?
Primarily one-on-one. I do have, I tutor for a lot of the AP high school classes.
Mm-hmm.
And before tests, we normally have group sessions. So, for example, AP US History is a big one that I do. And I'd have students, max 8 students, just because.
Is that like peer-to-peer, like the peer, they work together?
Well, what I do is I have study guides for them, and we mm-hmm. go through the study guides together, and we all sit at a big conference table, and then they get to ask questions, and I give them practice tests and practice questions. So for those, I don't mind doing group settings.
Uh-huh.
This week, because we do have an ACT test coming up on September 10th, I've been doing boot camp sessions.
So like at 5 in the morning?
Yesterday we
Two
had...
days.
I know. Well, it is for me, but yesterday we had an ACT math boot camp, which is just, you know, you have your big group setting, and it's not so much working one-on-one as just drilling them with as much math as possible, and they're taking notes and doing practice problems. So we do a little bit of both.
So how would you characterize the difference, if any, in your practice and what you might find at a typical big-name franchise kind of learning center?
Well, I think the main difference is, you know, a lot of times kids come in there because they're lacking foundational skills, whether that be reading comprehension or math or whatever it may be. And a lot of these programs do have kind of a program set up for them where they use the material and they... You know, whatever, whether it's whatever learning center or Sylvan, I'm not really familiar with what they do, but I know that, you know, they normally have set programs where they practice their reading, they practice their math, where for me, yes, I think that's important, but why not use your reading comprehension skills and read your history textbook and then get an A on the test as well? So for us, it's utilizing what you're using and doing in school to work on those skills. So you kind of get the best of both worlds.
Now, do you find any challenge in integrating what you're doing with what they are being exposed to in the school curriculum, so that you don't trip each other up, you and the school teacher, or has that not been a challenge?
A lot
so far?
Of times, you know, teachers are really willing to work with me, and yeah. much more for the younger students. I'm in communication with all the teachers. For example, tonight I'm going to the college night at Walton High School in East Cobb.
Oh, so you really have an active
right.
working relationship with
right.
these teachers.
And I actually went to Walton High School, and I work with a bunch of students at that school. So it's very interactive. I know the teachers. I know the counselors. And I think we complement each other really well.
Now, how do you get clients? Like, do they just look you up on the internet? Like, how do people even know you exist? There must be a million.
She's a radio personality.
Well, now.
I know. Well, now I know how to get there. But
from this point forward.
When I graduated from college, I planned on applying for a full-time teaching job.
Right.
And over the summer, I started tutoring and, you know, a family friend. And then that kind of spread one thing to another and really enjoyed it and kind of held off on applying for a teaching job and
right.
through word of mouth. I mean, I haven't really done any advertising.
But you've built up some clients and probably got referrals
built
from
up,
them.
Right, built up a client base, got referrals. It's mainly local referrals. So I do the main areas like Sandy Springs and East Cobb. Have some Buckhead students and Alpharetta students. But it's fairly local and it's just...
Are you traveling or they come to you?
I actually have an office in East Cobb. And so, you know, I have students come in. I have a main room where I tutor. Mm-hmm. I have several other rooms where other tutors are set up. And then I have homework rooms where after school kids can come in and check in or sign in, and they sit and they do their homework, because I think everyone in this room knows that if you're sitting at home, you want to get on Facebook, you want to get a snack.
So you don't have Wi-Fi.
The dog's barking. So for them, it's a really good, quiet environment for them to sit and, you know, have a structured time for them to get their stuff done. So
Do you do any virtual learning?
I don't. I think my dad's trying to convince me to get on that bandwagon, but not yet. So maybe we'll head in that direction.
So what advice, if any, do you have for a parent, child, team that might be shopping for a tutor? What kind of questions should they be asking when they're talking to someone that they might actually engage as a tutor?
Well, for me, you know, I think if you're in the tutoring industry, you obviously have something to offer in terms of helping kids get to where they want to be academically. I know that if students don't feel comfortable with the tutor, they're not really going to be motivated to do what they need to do. And, you know, what I tell my students is if they're not willing to put in the work, it's, well, why should I? So if they're willing to put in the time and the effort, then it's really a personal decision for them, and you have to find a good fit.
Have you ever fired a kid?
I have, and he came running back begging the next semester. I have a very, I wouldn't say a cutthroat approach, but it's tough love. For example, yesterday my kids were giving me a hard time. If I don't allow any negativity in my office. So, oh, I can't do this. This is so hard. Mm-mm. So for the boys, they have to do push-ups.
Oh, wow.
And the girls have to do jumping jacks. And there is no negativity. Because have you read The Secret? I think I got brainwashed.
What's The Secret?
The Secret?
What's
the
Tell
secret?
Us about this. What is it? Is it is like The secret? Secret? Is there a secret?
No, it's a book. And I can't remember the author's name. But basically, whatever you verbalize, you start attracting. Uh-huh. You attract that outcome.
I think there's probably a lot of merit to that.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't think you should come in with a bad attitude, because that has just as much an impact as how much time you put in prepping for it.
That's a new rule here at Business
New
Radio.
Rule. So
no negativity.
No negativity.
Oh, I thought you meant jumping jacks.
Well, that could be part of your workout regimen.
Yeah, I'm trying to implement that.
What's the best way for our listeners to get in touch with you and find out more about your work?
Well,
Are you overbooked now? Or you?
I'm overbooked right now. The wait list for this week is a little crazy. I'm at about 131 students.
Wow.
So I don't have a social life. So, but if you would like to look more into it, you can go to the website, which is www.loltutoring.com. And you can kind of look at us there. We also have a Facebook page. And you can kind of look us up and then see if that's something that you're looking for.
And then how many tutors work with you?
Right now I have three, but there's
you
there
and three
will
other
be
ones?
More.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yes.
Well, are you thinking about being a tutor?
Well, look, you know.
What, do you know anything about anything?
No, it's radio. I'll do your radio.
Okay, that could work.
I got to ask you before we let you go about this Facebook thing. How's that working out? You have a Facebook page for the business?
I do. I have a Facebook page for the business, and it's actually really good because you don't have to force kids to go on Facebook.
But they're not embarrassed to go on there and go, look, I'm getting tutoring.
No,
it's
a cool spot.
It's cool to get tutoring.
It's cool to get tutoring.
Okay.
It is, so. Now, when I update my statuses, like everyone has to do a journal this summer for summer reading and things like that, and it pops up on the home feed and kids are like, oh, I forgot about that.
Right.
So it is good because it's very accessible for them.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we thoroughly enjoyed it. Miss Danielle Viviers with A Love of Learning, LLC. Can you hang out with us? We got one more guest we're going to visit with this morning.
Of
Terrific.
Course.
Well, bringing it all home for us here at High Velocity Radio this morning is Mr. Rob Kizchuk. I'll find out in a minute if I pronounce that right, with Badgie. Welcome to the show, man.
Thanks a bunch. Good to be here.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for coming in. So, Badgie, this has something to do with this whole gamification. Is that a word, gamification?
It is now.
Well, tell us all about gamification and Badgie, and tell us about Kizchuk.
Sure. So, Kizchuk, you did a great job.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you.
On a somewhat difficult name. Gamification is sort of this realization in the era of Farmville that some of the techniques we use to make games, both board games or social games, even like Farmville, can be applied in a more simplified form to marketing, to engaging with consumers, to getting them to interact with, let's say, a brand or an idea or a contest. And so Badgy is a new company. It's my company. I started about a little over a year ago and got really serious about it a couple of months ago. And I come from a social gaming background. I've made a Facebook game called Zombie Mosh. I've made kids games, and I've done sort of social networking company as well. And so I come from this social and gaming background. And what I saw was that the companies that were trying to help other companies on Facebook use some of these gamification techniques were very raw, very unrefined, and they really weren't bringing the very best that, let's say, Zynga was bringing to Farmville and, you know, all these social games and stuff.
So is Zynga the best? Is that the gold standard?
Zynga is the best at getting the job done. I'm not going to say it's the best game.
Right.
It's the best at being effective. And so if you're a marketer, you want that, right? You want the best at being effective brought to bear on what you're trying to accomplish.
Right.
And really what I saw was that people doing very, very simple things like our page to get this content. And there's this whole ecosystem of requests and re-engaging people that these social games do a very good job of that brands were not, they're not getting access to that.
But is that a win, liking? Is a win, is that a good enough ROI from a business standpoint, getting a like or getting a follower?
So a like or a follower is a foot in the door, right? And at this point, nobody really knows how much is that worth over, you know, how long does Twitter or Facebook last? And what is the value of a person over time? But it is a foot in the door. It's an opportunity to engage, a lot like Danielle was saying. When she gets someone on her Facebook page, she gets their attention and they come back. And they're coming to Facebook every day. So she's got that foot in the door that when I update my status, people are going to see it here. And so that like is an opportunity. And so one of the things we do with some of the programs we do, we encourage rolling out content over time. So it's not put your whole game, all of your kind of campaigns out at once. It's release that over time. And then using some of these social gaming techniques, they're very good at getting friends to re-engage each other. So, you know, let me, you know, my cow needs feeding. Please feed my cow. People post right. that on their wall. And because people have liked or added that application, it shows up in their feed. That's an opportunity that marketers aren't getting as much access to.
So that seems like a kind of a paradigm shift in that you're not trying to kind of attract attention back to you. You're trying to attract attention to the friends of your prospect to get them to engage together to go back to you.
That's right.
That sounds very complicated, but it sounds like you guys know what you're talking about.
Right, because I want my friend to do something. I mean, you want my friend to do something for me is the win, not just have me come back and forth to the website. That's a littler win.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and then you ask, and then they accept, and then they say, well, you should thank your friend. And of course, right. you're going to thank your friend. I mean, that's just only polite. And so you get these sort of social reciprocity. I mean, these are hardwired into people. They like to say right. thank you. They like to get things for free. And tapping into those is pretty powerful.
Now, are there industries, types of businesses where this gamification really lends itself to more
farming?
Than,
it works well in farming.
Well, I was actually thinking about our last interview with Danielle on the tuning.
Right.
How cool would a little bit of gamification be in that and earning badges? I don't
would
know.
That work for her,
is that
Rob?
Is that a good application of that?
Is there a place for gamification in her business?
There's a lot of people talking about gamification of education. I think there's another
really?
Company in town called Open Study that's applying some of those things to their learning platform.
Mm-hmm.
And in general, you know, yes. I mean, think about even when you were a kid, right? You liked getting a gold star on your paper and
right.
you didn't like getting red ink on your paper. I mean, that's not really a game, but it is a feedback mechanism and it is something that has very deep psychological effects. You want the, you know, green 100%. You don't want the red like 70%.
And then you want your name on the board of these are the leaders you know, or who's got the best grades, right?
That's right.
Part of it, too,
yeah.
The scoreboards.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it occurs to me that the gaming, the reward system can be more elegant in those environments where it needs to be more elegant. And, you know, so maybe you don't want a cartoony starfish if you're a Wall Street firm. Maybe you want something, a more elegant-looking badge or something. But speak to that, if you will, how you customize or what kind of thought process goes into designing a gamification strategy for a Wall Street firm versus, you know, a couple of rednecks running a radio network.
Absolutely. So
you're putting me under redneck? Really? Really? Both of us, you're putting under redneck. Mr. Pensacola.
So what we start with is we have built, and where we provide value, is we have a toolkit of these are the techniques you could use to, you know, and we don't use gamify a lot, but that phrase, but it is very effective in conveying the industry.
What phrase do you use?
We use social engagement.
So, okay.
But gamification is a good shorthand. It's used a lot. It's also maligned a lot, that phrase.
Right.
So we have a toolkit of that's always growing of types of sort of badges or achievements or campaigns that you could unlock. We started off with Twitter only, and it was say this on Twitter, and then it was retweet this on Twitter, and now we can handle some more complicated scenarios on Twitter of, you know, if you mention us every day for a week, then you'll get a special unlock for that. And then we heard a lot of feedback that we should go over to Facebook. And so we have, you know, you expect to have something for liking a page, but maybe it's recruiting five friends. Maybe it's getting five friends to send you something. And so first you sort of look at the objectives of who you're working with. Are they on Facebook? Are they heavily invested in Facebook? Are they trying to get people to Twitter? Are they trying to get people to email? What are their needs?
Right.
So then you sort of pull from the toolkit. And quite often, we're actually working with a marketing agency. So we're working with a creative firm that has a relationship with the brand that can help translate some of that brand strategy onto this toolkit of these are the things you can do to engage people. Here's how it fits the message of the campaign you're trying to do. And so that can inform, you know, if you're trying to get people to email, we've got a MailChimp integration fund project that will make it so that when somebody clicks on Facebook, they can sign up for your email newsletter. So now you go from being, I'm looking at you on Facebook, to I'm a Facebook follow-up fan, a Twitter follower, and an email subscriber.
Right.
And so it's all about the brand's objectives, and it helps to have typically the agencies or somebody inside the company shaping the campaign.
So, but you're primarily the person that's implementing this? You're doing the kind of the nuts and bolts of making this work?
Yeah, we take the very complicated parts of getting requests in and out of Facebook and listening to everything that's going on Twitter to see, you know, at any given second, did somebody on Twitter somewhere mention you, mention
right.
what you wanted them to mention? It's a non-trivial problem,
right.
And it gets less trivial the more, you know, kind of conditions you put on it. So that's what we solve. The creative exercise we can help with, but it's more kind of educating and saying, okay, here's how this works. You know, here's the things that work well in different scenarios. How does that fit your objectives?
And so this is not a matter of dedicating more headcount to monitoring this stuff. You have automated processes that help us keep track of all this stuff.
Yeah, we can actually. So I don't know if I'd say we can reduce headcount, but what we can definitely do is let people be more effective. So when we talked to some of the agencies, they were just wasting a lot of time doing things like saying, congratulations, you entered our contest. Or, you know, make sure that somebody has to be following us in order to win this prize. Or we need people to send us their address so we can send a coupon to them. Things like that we can automate. So it's not necessarily, I don't know, I guess in the long run we save headcount. But in the short run, we make it so that somebody working on a Twitter or Facebook account doesn't have to push the button and say, is this person following us? Is this person following us? How influential is this person? We'll actually grab, I don't know if you're familiar with clout, we'll grab somebody's clout score
mm-hmm.
when they raise their hand and engage with a brand to see and kind of bubble up, okay, is there somebody really influential who's engaging with your brand, your product, and you didn't know it? We're going to point that out for you.
Right.
I wonder what your clout score is.
Not very good.
I want to know what Lee's clout score is. That's your homework assignment.
Okay.
Now,
and we're going to share that on the air.
Thanks. Now, you mentioned Twitter and Facebook. What about LinkedIn? Do you guys do anything there? Is there any opportunity there?
We get some inquiries on that from the kind of, there's many agencies that do a lot more work on the B2B side, and they ask
right.
about it. And really the difficulty there is that LinkedIn is a fairly closed platform. LinkedIn hasn't made it very easy for you to build applications around it.
Right.
So we continue to ask that question. I think we're probably tracking Google Plus a little bit more closely to see where it goes.
Uh-huh.
Because it shows a lot more signs of having kind of similar DNA to Twitter and Facebook in terms of what they'll let you do and how you can engage people.
So what's it like working through agencies? Because that strikes me as fraught with tremendous opportunity, but maybe a challenge or two as well, trying to work through agencies like that. You must really have to get to know each other and trust each other extremely well.
It is certainly, it's a relationship-based transaction.
Are they white labeling your work? Is that how you operate?
White label, or in some cases I would say gray label. If someone does a pure Twitter campaign, which is something we've done a couple of, there's nowhere we can send them from Twitter. Like, there's no, here's my brand's Twitter page, we're going to give you a badge. So
right.
What we'll do in that case is we will co-brand with our site. We did this with Quilted Northern. We actually had Quilted Northern toilet paper logo, Quilted Northern badge. Mm. We're up there as well. So we themed our site around them It's kind of like if you unlock a Bravo badge on Foursquare. It's kind of this sort of gray label where it's somewhere in between. Foursquare is visible, but the brand is prominent.
Well, I want to circle back to this, you know, where does this really fit? Because now the more I'm listening to this, it seems like almost a slam dunk for business to consumer, B2C. Mm-hmm. But is there a place for this kind of thing for B2B?
There may be. I don't think we're focused on that. I think just the way that the market has kind of directed us as we've gone out and talked to people, talked to both agencies and brands about what they want to do and especially what they're ready to do. There's been a lot more movement on the B2C side. And people ask on the B2B side, I mean, regularly, how can I use this on LinkedIn? And I keep looking. I'd love to answer it for them. But it's just kind of a, I don't know. I don't think the opportunity's there yet.
What about on blogs?
So that's an interesting question. Actually, a bunch of the other companies in this space are focused around either gamifying a blog or gamifying a website. So they'll take your company website and they will put badges all over it.
Right,
Huffington Post did
right.
this, and people spend months integrating this because if you can imagine working with a consumer brand's
right.
IT department to get all the deep hooks into their page, okay, when someone has 20 comments, give them a cookie,
right.
you know, that sort of thing. That whole deployment process is actually pretty complicated. And so similarly, with blogs, when you're talking about a brand, you know, what brands have a popular blog? There are some blogs that are popular brands, if that makes sense. So you
right.
have like your, you know, your Gawker and your Weblogs Inc. type categories of blog. But I don't know if there's a lot of brands with very successful blogs. So,
but would it work for, like, say, a Gawker where then if you go to one of the sister sites, you're getting, you know, they want to cross-pollinate their traffic to the sister sites by creating badges? Is that...
Yeah, that'll work. That works if you're a destination site.
Right.
What most people don't realize, whether they want to or not, is that they're not a destination site. And
right.
that's really hard to tell people. you know, it's really hard
they
to tell.
They don't want to hear that.
It's really hard to tell, you know, this, you know, Kirkland signature drinking water I'm drinking mm-hmm. here. Tell them nobody's going to go to your site and you can spend all the money mm-hmm. you want on that.
Right.
You know, putting these hooks into your site and people aren't going to come back every day. It kind of goes back again to what Danielle was saying, and this is part of our philosophy, is that
so
people
Danielle's
are on Facebook.
The linchpin here.
She is. Well, she is out there trying to reach customers, right?
Right.
And so, to her point, people are on Facebook every day. People are on Twitter every day. People are not on your website every day. And trying to convince them to do that is a very difficult
right.
proposition.
It's a bridge too far.
Yeah.
Right.
We're kind of more philosophically, we're going to help you find the person where they are every day.
Mm-hmm. Now, so when you're working with a client, so you have to have that. That seems like a harsh reality check for some companies when you have that conversation, is it?
Oh, you just don't say it directly. You focus.
How do you finesse that?
Well, so,
that
so
no one goes to your website and
your
you know.
Baby is butt ugly.
Thankfully, a lot of these budgets are very oriented around here's our social media budget.
Right.
And so there's not as much of a blur of, well, we should spend our social media budget on our website. Now,
right.
there might not should be such a bright line distinction, but there is, and it's helpful.
Now, there's some thought leaders in the space. I think you mentioned to me off air a Georgia Tech professor who thinks that gamification is garbage.
Yeah, he used a little sharper words than that. Yeah, you know, and I think what you see there is...
So he's saying it's a gimmick. This is just a little...
He's saying it's a gimmick. He's somewhat objecting to a one-size-fits-all approach to
right.
engagement with people. And to some extent, I agree. To another extent, I mean, he is in an academic environment. And from an academic perspective, do I think it would be great if everybody who wanted to have a great game that fit their brand perfectly and you know, people engage with and like make a really great big budget game for every single company, I think that would be great. The reality is, if you tried to do that and if you had everybody out there trying to buy that, you'd get a similar dynamic. You'd get a bunch of people shoving garbage down the pipe and some quality.
Right.
And so I think when you take games and you simplify them to some of their elements, as happens in the gamification space, you get this huge marketing push. And almost any time there's a huge marketing push, a lot of that looks like garbage. And then you get some people who advocate a one-size-fits-all approach. Let's not consider your brand strategy. Let's not consider anything you're doing. Just plug in our code and we will gamify you. And that's a little bit of garbage. I don't know that that's any different from any software industry.
Right. So you think that it has to be customized and it has to be aligned with their philosophy and what their overall arching objective is. You can't just kind of slap a game on every website.
Correct.
Now, there's an event coming up here in town where they're going to spend some energy in talking about this whole topic, right? Tell us about that.
That's right. So this Wednesday at 6:30 p.m., the Atlanta Interactive Marketing Association is having their monthly meeting, and it's on gamification. I think they've got a few different panelists, and they're going to be talking about several different cases, case studies, things people have done involving games and involving brands. And so a lot of people who are interested in digital marketing are going to be showing up to see, how does this work for me? It's still a very young space, even if there is a lot of chatter about it.
And so where can our listeners find out more about this upcoming event, and how can they get in touch with you and your team?
So if you Google for AIMA Atlanta, that will handle the event. I don't know the exact website. Our website is badgy.gy. I can be reached at rob@bad.gy or on Twitter, it's @badgy.
Well, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Anything I know about gamification, I learned in the last 20 minutes. How about you?
That's how good he is.
It was a very informative show this morning.
Yes, a little of everything.
Kind of an eclectic mix, don't you think?
Yes. Good job, Stone. Made that happen.
Yeah. Well, until next time, this is Stone Payton, Lee Cantor, and everyone here at the Business Radio X family saying we'll see you in the Fast Lane.